Every story told has a story of its own.
She said the words, "I won't forget it. What more do you want from me?"
It was on the fly decision making. It was drinking water from a fire hose at that point.
Every now and then, someone at a place like the grocery store might say something like, "I'm glad you're holding MPS accountable. That keeps my fire burning."
Bringing you the story behind the story. This is Reporter's Notebook. Now, here's your host, Adam Roberts.
Welcome to Reporter's Notebook, where we analyze in depth the biggest stories from the past week while also taking a deeper dive on those stories that deserve an extra look. I'm Adam Roberts. Thanks so much for joining me once again. We have a dandy of a program for you today. Coming up on the show, a man from Pewaukee wanted in connection to the deaths of his three young daughters in the remote Washington State wilderness. Were his remains discovered? And what is next in the investigation? We'll explore with John Mercure from Wisconsin's Afternoon News. Also, if you've noticed recently, politicians and public officials seem to be leaning more on the expression "no comment" when the media requests an interview or a statement on an issue. That may be because it is happening more frequently. We'll explore that potential with Wisconsin Watch managing editor Jim Malowitz, who wrote a piece on the topic a few weeks ago. He joins the show a bit later on. But first, I wanted to explore closer a story that first broke early on Tuesday and sort of not only encompasses both of the main wings of Reporter's Notebook, biggest stories of the week and stories that deserve a deeper dive, but also is a good case study in the process of reporting, which I think is the unspoken third wing sometimes of the show. It's a story involving six young children who were located locked inside of a storage unit on Tuesday early in the morning on Milwaukee's north side at the StorSafe facility on 27th and Silver Spring Drive. Police were first called around 1:30 in the morning from a caller concerned that they were hearing a crying baby inside one of the storage units.
Police are on scene requesting a forced entry. They believe baby is locked in one of the storage lockers.
Police and firefighters then arrived to the facility and found their way to Unit B58. Upon breaking the padlock on the garage door and looking inside, they located six children, aged from 2 months old up to 9 years, living in putrid conditions. It was noted in a criminal complaint there were no lights, electricity, or running water in the unit, which was in disarray, mattresses with no bed sheets, and a bucket that the children had clearly been using to go to the bathroom in. About an hour after their initial call, in a parking lot, police located the children's parents, 33-year-old Charles DePriest and 26-year-old Asia Zielinski. The pair admitted the children had been living in the locked facility for about a month and a half and also admitted they could have sent the children to live with other relatives. Both DePriest and Zielinski made their initial court appearances on Friday, and the case drew a strong response from Milwaukee County Court Commissioner Andrea Bullender when Zielinski made her appearance.
The only light these poor children had to have was the crack of light that came through the bottom of the garage. We have your children stating that they had no food, that the only food they found was from the garbage. The middle roll was completely empty, and the dog had the back row all to himself. As these children slept in a locked storage container with one twin mattress on the floor. This is horrific. Ma'am, I see you are broken up. I hope you realize how lucky you actually are that none of these children have died. Ma'am, do you understand those charges and the potential maximum penalties?
Yes, ma'am.
I mentioned at the start, this story is a great case study in how reporting plays out, especially in cases of criminal activity like Zielinski and DePriest are now charged with. Upon hearing of the story, I immediately filed an open records request with the city of Milwaukee to obtain police records, police interviews, and body camera footage connected to the situation. A few days later, my request was denied by Milwaukee Police Chief Jeffrey Norman. But in reality, this isn't all too uncommon. As the department's public information officer, Sergeant Efren Cornejo, noted on Wisconsin's Afternoon News this week, there's a lot of elements that factor into those records requests.
Depending on the status of that particular case, for example, they would be able to determine what can be released and what cannot at this time. I'll tell you, sometimes some of this stuff is timely, especially when you're requesting anything that involves body cam or footage, because they have to view it, redact it, and it could be very time consuming. So there's confidential information that has to be redacted too in some of these reports. Right. So they have to go through all that stuff to protect, you know, privacies of all the individuals.
Still, now that the charges have now formally been filed, we have submitted those records requests again and expect to hear shortly from Milwaukee Police. District Attorney for Milwaukee County Kent Lovern was on Wisconsin's Afternoon News Friday discussing the case and made it clear that both parties are innocent until proven guilty, and also that the case is not an indictment on homelessness.
We know there are a number of people in our community right now who are struggling with housing and who are struggling with homelessness, and we want them to find safe places to be. And I want to make it very clear, this office is not interested in criminalizing homelessness at all. But every situation would be different, right? And has to be viewed differently based on the facts and circumstances of the specific situation. And here, the combination of everything that was discovered here by the police led us to file the charges that we think are obviously appropriate here.
What also made this story interesting to cover this past week from my perspective as a reporter was the unwillingness to comment from StoreSafe itself. The supervisor at the facility on 27th and Silver Spring refused all media outlets' requests for comment or any statement on the situation, and phone calls to the corporate office as well as the number listed for the Milwaukee facility went unanswered. But as this case continues to draw a lot of attention both from the media and the general public, at some point a lot of questions will be answered. Key among them is whether or not the parents' admissions of the children being locked up in the facility for a month and a half are accurate. As in the criminal complaint, an employee at StoreSafe noted he had heard a voice from inside the unit as early as this past May saying, quote, "sit down and be quiet." Whether or not that was one of the parents involved remains to be seen. And of course, we will continue to follow this story very closely on WTMJ. I wanted to quickly revisit the ongoing story involving a Milwaukee County judge accused of obstructing federal ICE agents from carrying out the arrest of an undocumented illegal immigrant who was in the judge's courtroom this past April on an assault case. The man, Eduardo Flores Ruiz, the judge, Milwaukee County's Hannah Dugan. She was arrested and accused of her alleged crimes back in April. And since then, a legal back and forth has played out at the Milwaukee Federal Courthouse building downtown, with particular attention given to how the trial of Judge Dugan will play out once she is scheduled to be in court for her trial in December. There will, of course, be a federal jury selected for the trial. That selection is scheduled to begin December 11th. And the potential jurors in this case will be faced with a questionnaire before the trial begins. The questions involved in that questionnaire were determined this past Friday by U.S. District Judge Lynn Edelman, who's presiding over Dugan's case. What strikes me as interesting are the questions that will be excluded, that were proposed earlier this week, but Judge Edelman ultimately excised or removed from the questionnaire. Some of the questions that have been eliminated from the possible questionnaire include asking about potential jurors' religious organizations they may be linked to, as well as potentially asking the jurors to, quote, list any stickers, placards, signs, patches, symbols, and other messages that you display at home or on an automobile, motorcycle, bicycle, bag, backpack, laptop, computer, water bottle, etc. Another question that's been excised from the questionnaire, quote, how would you describe your political views? But notably kept in the questionnaire will be a question asking about what media sources the potential jurors get their information and news from. In his filing Friday, Judge Adelman noted his declining to excise question 13 involving news sources was due to the fact that he notes it's common for courts to ask prospective jurors about their news sources in higher profile cases. And the Judge Dugan case certainly has that high profile attachment to it. The political angles and storylines to the Judge Dugan case have already made themselves apparent. This was the case in released body camera footage from earlier this year, in the time frame between when the alleged incident at the courthouse with Judge Dugan and Eduardo Flores Ruiz occurred and when Dugan was ultimately arrested in April. In that small window of time, Milwaukee police officers were at Judge Dugan's home responding to a threat Judge Dugan said was made against her. There, she briefly spoke about the Eduardo Flores Ruiz incident, noting there was already a lot of interest in the case from media members.
Reporters calling me all day.
Okay.
A couple taxpayers are mad that I hid this guy in the jury room. I didn't do anything that they're saying. What I'm worried about is just the wackos that will believe this story, which is not true.
Legal teams on both sides of the case have until November 7th to file motions related to the case. And again, Judge Dugan's trial begins December 15th. No shortage of very big stories we were on top of this past week. That includes news that broke on late Thursday into early Friday out of Washington State involving the search for a man wanted in connection with the deaths of his three young daughters. Now, why are we talking about it on WTMJ? Well, the man in question, a native of the Pewaukee area, his name Travis Decker, you likely remember the name, wanted for the deaths of his daughters Peyton, Evelyn, and Olivia Decker. All three girls found dead at a campground in Washington State, and we learned this week the remains of a man believed to be Travis were found in the Washington wilderness. Chelan County Sheriff Mike Morrison.
Already worked with our detectives in the Washington State Patrol's crime lab. We're going to rush some results over there. We do feel pretty confident that there's a high probability this is him, just based off the clothing, some of the personal items that we found on scene. It was a heinous act. We're certainly continuing to keep Peyton, Evelyn, and Olivia in our thoughts and our prayers. It's what's been motivating us up to this point. Already been in touch with Whitney and her family, letting her know that we had made the find, and they knew that we weren't giving up. We encourage our community to continue to support us, and we understand people's frustration, but again, it just wasn't in our DNA. We continue to do the search, and this is why you continue to do it.
Wisconsin's afternoon news here on WTMJ has been on top of this story since the very beginning, and that includes our John Mercure, who's with me once again on Notebook. Welcome, John.
Hey, good to be here.
So the details came in pretty quickly late this past week. What do we know right now?
What we know is that police believe, sheriffs believe, that they've likely found the remains of Decker about three quarters of a mile from the crime scene. So to me, that seems like that's not that far. That's less than a mile away. But mm-hmm. the sheriff has said that that was outside the initial search areas. Hmm. And because the terrain there is so bumpy and uneven and heavily wooded, the primary search areas were smaller than if you were looking in a cornfield where it would be easy to search a lot of land in a short order. So three quarters of a mile from where the girls were found outside the initial area, there's still additional DNA analysis going on, which tells me that they believe he's been dead for quite some time.
That was going to be one of my questions, was just the timeline of when these deaths of the young girls happened versus when, whether he took his own life or whether he died when that happened, that's still being determined.
Yeah, so the girls went disappearing, or I should say he disappeared and the girls died on, they believe, May 30th. So almost 4 months were coming up on. So May 30th, and initially, remember, there were big searches.
Right.
And then they announced, I think it was in July, that they were actually scaling back the searches. They said, leads have kind of dried up, we're scaling back. And then just a couple of weeks ago, they shut down an area. They shut down the roads. They made sure everybody left, and they did an intense search. They said they had received more information. That was just a couple of weeks ago. But he's been sought for more than 3 months now, closer to four, like 3.5, 4 months since the girls were killed.
John, you've been on a lot of these high-profile stories, whether you've been yourself covering or analyzing on your show over the years. With this particular case, I noticed a lot of ebb and flow. We would get a peak of information, and it was the top story on all both our stations and out in the Washington and Seattle areas. and then it would flow away and you wouldn't hear anything for a while. Then suddenly the leads get hot again, and then it would flow away again, and then we get the peak with these remains being found. Is that typical in these sort of missing murderer cases?
It can be. I think what the things that made this atypical was that the sheriff, Mike Morrison, decided to be really front and center. Mm-hmm. He did a lot of interviews. They had a lot of press conferences, especially initially. He did interviews with outlets there. He did interviews with us. He's been on our show a couple of times. That's unusual in that usually there's an initial press conference. Maybe a couple days later, there's another one. And then things get really quiet until there's a development. Mike Morrison, the sheriff there, and other leaders, including those with the FBI, continued to take our requests and continued to talk. So that meant the ebb and flow, to your point, really went up and down, because when he would talk, there would be more interest, more information, and more reporting. And that usually doesn't happen. That's a good observation. Usually it's busy, 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 and then it's quiet till it's busy, busy, busy again.
This is the second case locally, or at least with a local connection, that I've noticed this in. The other one is Sheriff Mark Podall in Green Lake County when Ryan Borgwart, the kayaker, faked his own death, fled to Uzbekistan. That also felt like it was kind of all over the place in terms of when we got info.
You're right. That one was interesting because they were still looking for help. They were still looking to find where Borgwart was. And so I think in that case, the sheriff kept it out there because he wanted help. He wanted people to come forward. It was more like a great mystery. The one with Decker, we in Wisconsin weren't going to be able to likely provide any leads or any new information because of the geography. It just wasn't likely at all. But I think maybe it's a change in strategy in some departments, that they're being more transparent. They're getting out in front of things. Both of these sheriffs also had the reputation for being very out front, not being afraid of the camera, and liking to be in front of the microphones and give information.
WTMJ's John Mercure with me on Reporter's Notebook. Thanks, John.
Hey, I'm always pleased to be on the show. Thanks for having me.
Quick question. How many times have you, if you're listening to the news on TV, radio, or elsewhere, or some other variation, heard this sentence or something similar to it? Congressman X denied our request for an interview, but did release a statement reading in part, da-da-da-da. Governor X turned down our questions on policy Y, but did say, da-da-da-da. It's a pattern that in 2024, the Poynter Institute examined in depth, citing some examples of reporters being shut out from stories by public officials. Some of these examples included in Daytona Beach, Florida, where a sheriff refused to alert a local paper to news conferences or even comment about crimes after a dispute online over that outlet's coverage of stories. Locally, an incident that got national headlines came during President Trump's first run for office in 2016, when a Washington Post reporter was denied entry to a Mike Pence event at the Waukesha County Expo Center. This happened also on multiple occasions in 2024 during his administration's second run for office. So what are the understated impacts of the no comment response, and how can reporters overcome this sort of stonewalling when they're out on a story? We turn now to Jim Malowitz, the managing editor for Wisconsin Watch, who recently wrote a column on the topic titled "Your Right to Know, No Comment is No Help to the Public." Jim joins us now on Reporter's Notebook. Welcome, Jim.
Thanks so much for having me.
So before we get into your piece that you wrote earlier this month, as well as where it came from and what we can learn from it, let's get a little bit more on your background, because you came to Wisconsin Watch, I believe it was 2019, is that correct?
Yes, right before the pandemic.
Oh, perfect timing. Great time to get all of these need-to-be-out-in-the-field stories, and then suddenly no one's out in the field. So share a little bit about some of your professional background that got you to this point now where you're the managing editor.
Sure. Well, I've had a career so far that's been mostly in nonprofit public affairs journalism. I started back in grad school, helped my investigative journalism professor launch the Iowa Center for Public Affairs Journalism, iowawatch.org, which later merged into Investigate Midwest. And I went on to report for about 4 years at the Texas Tribune in Austin, and going all around Texas reporting on energy and then also investigative journalism. I reported for a couple of years in my home state of Michigan at Bridge Magazine, which is a nonprofit there. before transitioning from reporting into editing for the past 6 years here at Wisconsin Watch.
So I'm catching during that description, I heard a lot of nonprofit mentioned a few times. What about that line of investigative reporting drew you in from the start?
Right. And it's the combination of nonprofit and independent nonpartisan journalism, right? There are, you know, nonprofits of various sorts, and some might have a partisan or political bent. The organizations that I've been working for and really finding value in are the ones that we talk about how we're independent and we, seek to basically just like report the truth and also report information that's going to help people navigate their everyday lives. We're not looking at anything through an ideological lens. We're just really focused on, kind of helping communities become, stronger, more connected. Hoping to make communities a little bit more cohesive.
In your time at WisWatch, have you gotten comments from consumers that are ever asking you to explain, okay, what does this mean? Explain to me how you guys are staying center line and not shifting either left or right at all.
Absolutely. You know, and I think in a lot of newsrooms, there's you kind of get comments from folks on either side of the aisle who might be reading something that challenges their own worldview. You hear a lot from the president of the United States and then, readers about how the quote unquote liberal media, which is a very, catch all term for things that they don't like. But we definitely get comments on, various sides of the aisle. It's when we talk about being nonpartisan and independent, it can seem subjective, right? What does it even mean to be liberal? What's it mean to be conservative? And really, like we do, at Wisconsin Watch, we have a set of values that we operate through. So again, we're thinking a lot about solutions journalism. We're identifying problems that might hold people back in their communities. We're trying to, report for people who might be underserved. Some people might see that as partisan. We see that as sort of a value proposition, but we're not going to, sugarcoat anything, or we're not going to, advocate for anything other than making sure that people have the information they need to navigate their lives and hold their officials accountable.
So on that note then about holding officials accountable, because that's sort of a perfect circle moment to back what we're talking about today, which is this idea of the rise in the no comment. So looking at some historical context first, in your understanding of how we got to where we are now, is there a point we can look to where public officials' sentiment towards answering media questions started to shift from a more open approach to the no comment or referring you to a comms person?
Right. I do kind of think it's a kind of gradual slide that's really happened. I think probably throughout my career. So I've been reporting for the past 15 years or so. And it's just something that's kind of like gradually happened. I mean, I think we're in a phase right now. I think it's fair to say that, our current president's kind of war against independent press has fueled a little bit more of that avoidance of inconvenient questions and things like that. But this really has been happening for a long time, that, and it's just accelerated. And I think, part of it maybe is the way politics have changed, but I think part of it too is the way just media consumption has changed. I think there's an argument that some politicians don't see as great of a value proposition of engaging with us, sadly, as maybe broader trust in independent media has declined for a variety of reasons, including the way news is spread on social media and on the internet, and politicians can share information in a more, they might call it unfiltered way directly to constituents. But, whether it's through Facebook posts or Twitter or Blue Sky or whatever their app of choice is, TikTok, they're able to, when they don't engage with the media, they're not, getting challenged with tough questions that are inconvenient to them.
And do you think that that could also sort of have the counter effect of, if you're only putting out statements or messages through your carefully curated social media, doesn't that seem to kind of conflict with this idea of being open to the public, when even the general audience typically knows that those pages, if they're, even if they are run by the person who they actually says it is, it's still being carefully put under a microscope, whatever they're saying?
I would think so. Yeah, the social media channels, they create sort of the appearance of it being unfiltered, but you're right. That's a really great point, Adam, that it's like, this is can be an incredibly filtered process. It's just who's doing the filtering, right? Journalists like us at Wisconsin Watch, or whether it's the Journal Sentinel or Wisconsin State Journal, you know, we have a set of values that we operate under when we're thinking about what questions to ask and what to include in a story. And, you know, we're trying our best when we're mission driven to include the information that we think is relevant to the public. And, you know, you would hope that our politicians would do that too, but, you know, they might be tempted sometimes to just filter out the information that's most relevant to making them look good.
We're talking with managing editor at Wisconsin Watch, Jim Malowitz, here on Reporter's Notebook. Another angle I wanted to explore a bit on this, Jim, is we talk about the changing nature of media, how people consume and disseminate their information in 2025, very different from even 2015 or 2005 or 1995. And I'm also wondering, as now a new generation, not just of media consumers, but media reporters comes up, how much do you think it needs to be emphasized when new journalists and new reporters come through their education that there has to be a different approach to how we ask people in positions of power questions? Can we simply rely on the old method for investigative journalism, or does that have to change as well?
Well, I think everything we do really has to change. And I want to be clear too, while you know, the basis of this interview and the column I wrote too is very much calling out public officials for not engaging. I want to recognize the role that we as independent journalists have, where we need to change too, and we need to think more about how we build trust, really with the public, which is most important, but to some extent, you know, politicians as well. We need to make sure that our work is perceived as fair and as rigorous as possible. And we can't just sort of sit back and say, you know, we're journalists, talk to us, right? We have to sort of show our work as much as possible. You know, the hope is, and some of the more gratifying experiences I've had in my career with public officials who maybe we had somewhat of an adversarial relationship or adversarial exchanges over time, where at the end, if I left a previous job, they would say, you know what, I know we butted heads sometimes, or I wish you wouldn't have reported certain things, but, you know, I thought you were fair. And I think we need to figure out how we get back to that. And it really is, you know, there's somewhat of a bedside manner when it comes to asking questions of politicians, of the journalists. Like, as much as you might get annoyed by being ignored, or, you know, annoyed by, you know, any animosity in a politician's answers when they do engage, you know, we kind of have to rise above the fray and be, you know, as Midwest nice and polite as possible, stand up for ourselves and defend why we're doing this and not, you know, get walked over, but be respectful in that and not kind of, I guess, accelerate any, you know, aggressiveness if conversations ever kind of get a little bit out of control.
But you do a good point of emphasizing that it's a very delicate dance that we do in our industry. And I recall a while back we had an interview, actually just on our past episode, with the new manager of the Milwaukee Streetcar, James Veneau. And we had him in. It was a one-on-one conversation. And someone asked me after that interview aired, I wish you'd have gone after him about this thing that I want to know about the streetcar. You really should have hammered home on this. And I kind of had to share, like, look, I'm going to hold this man to account because he's in a position of power running a system that a lot of people have certain thoughts about. But also, it's our first conversation. If you just go full bore, boom, 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 hit him with all the questions right off the out of the gate, you've burnt that relationship already before you've really even gotten a chance to know each other.
Absolutely. I mean, that's a really great point. Like, we are all people deep down. And, you know, a lot of this is just like, you know, basic human interaction. You know, and some of the lessons of good journalism that builds trust are just lessons for non-journalists too, and, you know, how we should interact with each other and, you know, be respectful. And so I think it can go a long way just to make sure, you know, you're articulating your values, why we're doing this, this exercise of, you know, doing an interview, why are we writing the story, and just being really transparent about what we're seeking to get out of it. You know, politicians, you know, if they've been around the block, you know, generally know the parameters of media interviews and things like that, maybe more so than a member of the public who hasn't engaged with media before. Maybe we need to be even more careful when we interview just kind of everyday folks. But even with politicians and people in power, it never hurts to just be as transparent and fair and respectful as possible.
Jim, before we let you go, I have asked other guests on this show in the past when it's been their first time on, and I'll ask you the same question. As someone who's been in this industry now, you've mentioned for 15 years, what drives you every day to get better at what you do?
Well, really, what drives me every day, I guess, is just knowing that we serve a greater purpose. I think when I started out in journalism as a young journalist, like part of it was like, it's really cool to be able to go out and learn new things. I'm a curious person. I want to write things that make me interested. But what drives me every day now is knowing, especially being at a mission-driven organization like Wisconsin Watch, is the engagement that we get in response to our reporting, and knowing that we are serving a wider purpose and really are trying to serve the public, and inviting the public to shape our reporting. We're going out and asking people, what do they want and need to know, especially when it comes to questions they have for the public officials. And it's really, really gratifying to hear responses from people who find that our reporting resonates. And it's also gratifying when someone says, you know, hey, this is great, or maybe even is critical of our story and says you left something out, and then they're informing us of how to do our job better. So like those really two-way conversations are what kind of keeps me going. And, you know, again, even when we get criticism, we know that somebody is taking the time to read our work, engage with it, and somebody cares enough about the issues we're covering to engage. And that's just feels really good and makes it feel like this all still matters.
Jim Malowitz is the managing editor for Wisconsin Watch with us on Reporter's Notebook. Jim, thanks so much.
Thank you.